Res Publica. Celebrate the week, really. It's about democracy and human freedom. Let us record on this page, dear poem, the waiting in your voice to rise up. Still, here in the silence, I see the branches, and through them the light of morning breaks. And in the village, the chapel bell rings out the moment of this present truth, as always now, calling lovers to untangle, to face the orchestration of today. Good Carpe Diem, right now stand up and everywhere recite the mantra of democracy, as old as ancient Greece, and like brothers stepping from the polis, let us shake each other's hands, be equal in the eyes of every man, and dare to listen to our hearts. Bearing witness to all of this, I hear old freedom lowing in the far-off hills, and to the west the graves of those we love, as they join in, rise up in spirit. We bear in mind that they are our own kind, and since they live through us and show our love, our loss reigniting the naked flame, ever filling the valley of past despair, injustice, the apprenticeship of every day for every man who toils to be free. What's more, acknowledge their just grief, and with our heads held firm for the cause, march with the morning star to our new Jerusalem. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Tom. And now we have Tina Fisco.
Sorry, I can't make it on her. This is a name poem. It's a... what were you saying? To join us in poverty?
It's called The Letter. It could be a final reminder, which wouldn't be that bad. It's not really that bad until the solicitors get involved. It could be the oil bill. Good luck with that one, lads. Your bill is important to me and will be dealt with in strict rotation as soon as I get some money. It could be a final note, a final notice, threatening legal action, in which case I'll gird my voice and call to negotiate some bullshit payment plan I can't pay. It could be a summons for that ticket I couldn't pay, or perhaps another note from the revenue who don't seem to know that I'm on the dole. It looks official. Maybe I've won something, a contest I forgot I entered, or maybe money's due from some far-flung lending library, or a check from the universe with no return address. Or maybe not. It could just be the builders again. I owe them 200 euros since October.
Do we have a second poem along here? Was that some of your old name points here?
Okay, there you come then.
This is called Phone Call. It's about the communication or lack of communication between two people. Phone Call. Cable and cord carry her voice, twisting its way to his ear. A welter of words gathers and grows, entangles the mind, opens the heart. Familiar game of hide and seek. He holds on to fragments, pieces together, misses and hints to background drone of past distress. Listens to recent grievances aired, sifts and weighs what he might reply. He tiptoes through mind fields, careful to clarify what seems to jar. Into the night, words interweave, only to mask what screams to break out in case it crosses the line.
Thank you, Mary. And now next we have Mike Gallagher.
Thank you. is a poem about immigration and how West Coast of Ireland was decimated in the 50s and 60s, partly 50s and 60s, and now it's been revisited. And it's also a poem about relationships, mostly about between myself and my father. I was lucky enough to be nominated for the Hennessy for next year.
Oh, congratulations.
Stick on stone. We knew each other only as men. Immigrations after that. Him in London, me in Ashton. Me in London, him in Luton. Even living together, we remained strangers in a rented room, speaking, not talking, robbed of our relative belongings. Sure, there were memories. One golden holiday when the FBI called, we straddled the low stone wall, talked of Wimpy and McAlpine, roads and bridges, gigs and pubs. The boy was a man. At lunchtime, Bose and Wandsworth, three of us now living in London, yet chatting only the once. Inheritance was split, spoils divided, unequally, but with good humour. Pollock was always his favourite, and mine. Nights in Castlebar Hospital, after the immigrant's dreaded summons, come now. But he still knows you. Between the awkward silences came words of stunted support, and he survived again and again. I almost made it that last time. Got to Westport before news of our final silence. Now, as I walk in the mother, his narrow stick, a stolen spoil, taps the unsaid on the tower stone. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike, and congratulations. And now next we have the regular Patricia Walsh.
If you still exist, sing your song. And now to the war besides that I told you, now we're on the fight. There are times I didn't want to, but fate after the can would have none of it. You, the first item on my beautiful list, just had to go. The imaginary time spent in twain has had no harmony with higher plans. Your twangs in the hierarchy just strangled with cords. How I wish to save your sweet voice, pulling my voyage into craggy out there is away from the world. Danger happens to others until then. I, the human, love my life on the rocks. Struggling for survival, I have to take yours. I have pieced together your broken body, shattered with abandoned grief. That still in my mind this framework could call it the church music, word for word, as was played at your funeral. Nothing can translate the cadence of your voice, rising and falling carelessly with crash. Yes.
Thank you very much, Patricia. And next we have somebody who's becoming regular, maybe, Annette Gate.
This is for the week that's finished, I suppose, and it's called On Witnessing Student Protest, November 2010. From the back of the dresser, I pulled out the cracked I Support the Miners mug. A man in a hard hat, his wife and child, a profile in blue like kings on a coin, defending Britain's coal for Britain's future. It held an epipinch, two pencils, and collection boxes rattling at pigeon-suited commuters on London Bridge Station, and women hawking trays of political crockery. I'd used it at tea break and found myself at odds with the office. Nothing new. In that time as the bell rang, I went bomb scared. At night on the news, we'd see strong men ridden down by cops on horseback, bludgeoned to the ground. Eventually, Thatcher nudged me to the boat and a new land where people seem to matter. Now on YouTube, I see young girls in skinny jeans and makeup cordoned in by horses. They sit down on a Dublin street, holding up hands like suppliants. But the guards have put on hubris with their helmets. One kicks his mount forward. The camera phone closes on two slender hands splayed against the horse's breast. The clip stops, but I cannot leave her there. I hand her paint, a brush. Smoothly, she rises, parts the uniforms on the government office steps. The doors slide open. She sets down her can on the marble, paints words wide as her arm on the smart foyer wall. Old men, your minds are dust. We are your imagination. Cherish us.
I was challenged to read this by the teacher who made me do it. I'm taking a workshop right now, and just explaining homework that this is that we were challenged to write a poem of exaggeration, either saying that we're the best person in the world, God's gift to everything, or the worst person in the world, the scourge of the universe, right? It's based on a model poem by an actual person who did something like that. Of course, it's the whole point is to get you out of your comfort zone and write something that you wouldn't be comfortable with. But of course, I'm more comfortable with writing one where I'm scourge of the universe. So here it is. Tongue in cheek, right? I don't actually think this, you know, call it a hospital. Right? Jennifer Matthews is a disaster of seismic proportions. Every sentence uttered kicks houses from their foundations, destroying the families inside. China flings itself in cabinets when she opens her mouth. Each word let free is a window shattering one by one. Her singing voice is accompanied by car alarms, dogs, twisters, plane crashes. When Jennifer walks, entire fields of crops drag behind her as she like toilet paper on a sheer field. Topsoil tumbles off into rivers which run to mud. Generations go thirsty and then starve. Their crops parched. She is the scourge of the heartland. Pestilence, plague, and war are her protege. Her master shadow, darkening everything divine like a cloud of nuclear fallout, ready to take the globe and the bear hug. Thank you.
Intellectual legs walking proudly behind his secret sack of jewels.
such observance is allowed, even when you hold love in your eyes, heart and soul for a man who knows your touch and breath unlike his own. But where in this cosmic orgasmic litosphere of lust do I belong? And his eyes stare possessed and undressed at the hourglass girl. Another hour, another glass, another bar, another girl. This gaze is unknown to the lady in black. I long for this attention when I turn my back. Yet unaware, I must be the focus of a few, tangling us in lust, loneliness and curfew. To the true curse of life, to have both eyes on the same side of your head. But Eve is probably to blame for spilling virginal ink in her head.
That's lovely, Jean, thank you. And next we have Nicole Dorosta, I think.
Stony eye, for Mayor Mark Bethune's today.
Thank you, Governor. And next we have Tyke.
This one is called "I Hope That I Never Become Unbearable to You." I hope that I never become unbearable to you, like Hamlet, born on your back a thousand times, carried often through the minefield of madness, safely landed, grounded in a place where ordinary people dwell, my rock, the keeper of my place of refuge. I think sometimes you bore me, like a mother bore me, you know. You hold me, but never back, always encouraged to fly. I bear my soul, you bear my weight, on days when all I feel is heavy and I barely aware of your burden.
Thank you, Taj. I'll get that right next time, I'm sure. Conor McManus is our last year's night.
Thank you, sir. This is, I suppose, I just thought I'd read this for the week that's in it. Herself coming on Friday. It's a love story. The Captain's View. Joe Brennan stood motionless beside the witch hazel. His heart pounded hard as he pulled the revolver from his greatcoat pocket. Raising it slowly, he aimed at the captain, his head bent, napping. Brennan knew that Captain Caldwell, not yet 32, would be seated in the drawing room looking out at the lazy river lit by the moon and dappled shadowed by willow. Feathers of red and blue and yellow speckled the desk in front of him. Since his return from the front, the captain spent his time ordering exotic bird feathers and threads and hooks from mail-order catalogues to combine with rabbit fur or horsehair that Dan McGuire, the gardener, brought him to make daddy long legs and black gnats and hare's ears. And in the evening, when Madame Caldwell brought him his tea, he would ask her to have the flies arranged in sixes and put on bite backing and frame. This she had done for a number of weeks after his return, but now, 2 years later, they accumulated like dead blue bottles in jars and tins on the windowsill of a disused room. At this time in the evening, as the fire in the drawing room flickered and threw itself onto the small rectangular panes that made up the Georgian window, McGuire would tap on the glass to get the captain's attention and say good night before going home. Dan and the captain grew up together, Dan having just turned 13 when he first came to work in the gardens. And when Sidney Caldwell enlisted, so too did he, and so too did his childhood friend, Joe Brennan. But things had changed when the three had returned to the small town. Sidney had become the captain, but people knew he wasn't right in the head. Joe Brennan never took to any job and hung around Lazy Mac smoking woodbine and playing with cold fagions deep in the pockets of his greatcoat. McGuire still had his garden. There was the rose corner giving off its powerful perfume as it soaked in the tepid sun and climbed the whitewashed wall. There were plum tarts and apple tarts and blackberry jam from the fruits of his harvest in September. And on a frosty moonlit night such as this, he was permitted to gaff a salmon in the shallows upriver. But to the dismay of Madame Caldwell, Dan McGuire spent most of his time cultivating what he called the captain's view. That space of ground between the drawing room window and the river. He ensured it was in full bloom all year round, and it had become something of note among visitors to the estate. Its centrepiece in winter, halfway between the window and the river, was a Chinese witch hazel with its yellow burst of ribbon-like petals. Regularly Dan would send cuttings indoors so the captain could appreciate its aroma. And when he should be working elsewhere, Dan would often return on his breaks to sit out of view on the riverbank and throw small rocks into the dark, still pool that the willow sucked from. the splash would attract the captain's attention, and he would watch the concentric circles move outward towards each bank. The thought of a great salmon lying at the bottom of the pool excited him. He imagined it as it turned in colour from sea silver to bog brown, living off its store of fat by waiting to move further upstream to the fast-flowing shallow waters and spawn among the rocks. That would keep him going for a week, and the next time Dan passed the window he would signal to him that the great one jumped again and that he'd be ready for the 1st of January. But salmon seasons came and went, and the captain never left the house. He never left his position inside the drawing room window. And it was Maguire who had told Brennan this in amicable conversation. Prior to the troubles, Brennan had frequently asked after the captain, and now and again sent a woodbine with Maguire up to the big house. That evening, the movement outside the window attracted the captain's attention, and he raised an arm in stilted wave, thinking it was Maguire. Brennan's outstretched arm jerked with every thump of his pounding heart. He held his breath to steady himself. Breathing loudly through his nose, he gained composure. As he watched the captain slowly wave, a searing pain ripped across his face, throwing him off balance. It was Maguire, gaff in hand. Brennan fell to the ground in the darkness, firing blindly. A whoosh of sparks lit the night. From the drawing room, the captain stared blankly, trying to make sense of the silhouettes. Brennan, gun in hand. Dan Maguire lying motionless, dead, beside the witch hazel. Thank you.